Him glance at me again, checking my bedraggled state. I felt like a dog left in the backyard during a sudden rain. He leaned sideways on his seat, pulling out a handkerchief that he passed to me. Gratefully, I mopped at the trickles of water running down my face. Thanks.
You going back to the airport?
Not looking like this. Besides, I've already missed my... Shit. I realized with a jolt that I'd left my plane tickets in the shoulder bag I'd abandoned. I patted my blazer pockets, but there wasn't any point. I couldn't believe it. Of all things, in my haste, I'd simply missed the airline envelope. If I just grabbed the ticket, or better yet, held on to the bag itself. Now all I owned were the odds and ends I carried on my person. I was nearly sick with regret. The plane ticket represented not only my return home, but most of my liquid assets. I banged on the steering wheel. God damn it, I said. Laura leaned forward against the front seat.
What's wrong?
I left my plane ticket back there.
Uh-oh.
Well, it's gone now, she said, stating the obvious with what looked like a smirk. If I hadn't been at the wheel, I'd have leapt in the back seat and bitten her. Ray must have seen the expression that crossed my face.
Where are we headed?
He asked, probably hoping to avoid a rabies quarantine. I don't even know where we are, I groused. I pointed to the glove compartment. You got a map in there? He opened the glove compartment, which was empty except for the rental car contract and a whisk broom with chewed-looking bristles. He snapped it shut and checked the passenger door pocket. I slid a hand into the pocket on my side, coming up with assorted papers, one a neatly folded map of the United States. Ray grunted with satisfaction and flipped on the overhead light. Spread out, the crackling map took up most of the available space.
Looks like you need to keep an eye out for U.S. 30 heading northeast.
Where to? Laura glanced over at him. I bet to Louisville, right? He turned to her.
You got a problem with that?
Gilbert's not a fool, Ray. Where you think he's going?
So the guy goes to Louisville. Who gives a shit? We're talking about a 12-hour drive. He's never going to figure out which route we took.
Listen, Einstein, there's only one, she said.
Can't be. That's bullshit. There must be half a dozen, he said.
She reached over and snatched the map away. You've been in prison too long. I could hear her flap the map noisily in the back seat, refolding it while she found the section showing Dallas and points east. Look at this. There's maybe one other way to go, but 30's the obvious choice. All Gilbert has to do is drive like a maniac and get there first.
How's he going to find us? Once we get to town, we'll take a couple motel rooms and use fictitious names. Pay cash and call ourselves anything we want. Isn't that what you did?
Yeah, and look what happened. Kinsey found me in no time flat. So did Gilbert, for that matter.
It was a fluke. Finding you was pure accident. Ask her, he said.
I wouldn't call it a fluke, I said, taking offense.
You know what I mean. The point is, it's not like you deduced what she was calling herself and tracked her down from that. All you did was follow her, right?
Yeah, but what about Gilbert? How'd he manage it, I asked. Ray shrugged.
He probably persuaded Farley to spill the beans.
From the back seat, Laura moaned.
Oh, jeez, is that true? I hadn't thought about that. You think Farley's okay?
I can't worry about that right now, Ray said.
I glanced back at Laura, still in charge of the map.
What's the nearest big town between here and there?
Laura checked the map again.
We get to Texarkana first, and then Little Rock. After that, it's Memphis, then Nashville, and straight on up. Why?
Because I'm heading home. We'll take a side trip to the airport in Little Rock, and I'll catch a plane. What about your ticket? Ray asked.
I'll call a friend of mine. He'll help. Laura said,
In the meantime, how about a pit stop before I wet my pants?
Sounds good to me, Ray said.
I watched the highway signs until I spotted an off-ramp that boasted the international symbols for food and potty chairs. Half a block off the road, we found a poorly lighted independent gas station with a cafe attached. Even Gilbert wasn't canny enough to ferret us out here. The gas tank was still very close to full, so I bypassed the pumps and parked off to one side, away from the street. Ray headed for the men's room while Laura opened the trunk and pulled out her duffel bag. You can borrow my dress.
In the sour light of the ladies' room, I removed my Reeboks and wet socks, and then peeled off my damp blazer, blue jeans, turtleneck, and soggy undergarments. I was shivering again, but Laura's dry clothes began to warm me almost as soon as I pulled them on. She still wore the dark green corduroy jumper with a white turtleneck under it, while I was assigned the denim dress, a pair of tights, and slightly oversized tennis shoes.
"See you in a minute," she said.
She left the restroom, giving me a few minutes alone. I ran water in the sink until the hot came through, then rinsed my face and doused my head, washing out the smell of smoke. I used the harsh paper toweling to dry my hair, then used my fingers to comb the strands into place. I felt a wave of nausea rush through me like a hot flash. I put my hands on the sink, leaning on my arms while I composed myself. Sunday night, and I was stuck in some nameless Dallas suburb with an ex-con, his daughter, and a papoose of illicit cash. I let out a big breath and stared at my reflection in the dingy mirror. I shrugged ruefully. Things could probably be worse. So far, no one had been hurt, and I had a few bucks left. I was looking forward to a meal, though I'd have to depend on my companions to pay for it. As soon as we got to Little Rock, I'd put a call through to Henry, who would come to my rescue. He could wire me money, buy the airline ticket on his credit card, or some combination thereof. By morning, I'd be safely tucked in my bed, catching up on my sleep while I counted my blessings. I went back to the car, stuffing most of my damp belongings in the trunk beside Ray's suitcases. The blazer, though still damp, I carried with me into the cafe, unwilling to have it out of my sight. The place was largely empty and had a homely, neglected air. Even the locals must have eschewed the establishment, which had probably started as a mom-and-pop operation and been reduced sometime since to its current orphaned state. I didn't see any flies, but the ghosts of flies past seemed to hover in the air. The front windows were swathed in dust from some half-finished construction across the street. Even the fake potted plants carried a powdering of soot. Ray and Laura sat across from each other in a corner booth. I slid in beside Ray, not that eager to have his bruised and battered face in view while I was trying to eat. Laura didn't look much better. Like me, she wore no makeup. But while bare skin is my preferred state, she'd been carefully camouflaging the blows Gilbert had systematically administered. I had to guess that most of her bruises had been inflicted some time ago, because the darkest discolorations had washed out to mild greens and yellows. Ray, by contrast, was a veritable rainbow of abuse, scabbed and cut and restitched here and there. I kept my gaze pinned to the menu, which offered all the standard items: chicken fried steak and chicken fried chicken, hamburgers, fries, BLTs, grilled cheese sandwiches, and fresh soups, probably poured from big cans in the back. We ordered cheeseburgers, fries, and large, nearly fizz-free Cokes. Without carbonation, the soft drinks tasted like the syrups once used as home remedies for ladies' maladies. The waitress had the good grace not to quiz my companions about their injuries. While we ate, I said to Ray, "Just out of curiosity, once you get to Louisville, how will you figure out where the money's hidden?" He finished a bite of burger and wiped his mouth with a paper napkin. "Don't know that yet. Johnny said he'd leave word with Ma in case something happened to him, but who knows if he ever got around to it. Deal was I'd get out of prison and come find him in California. Then the two of us would go back to Louisville and pick up the money. He wanted things ceremonial, you know, celebrate all the weight and all the hard work went into it. Any rate, as near as I can tell, wherever the money's at, it takes a key to get to."
"Which I have," I said. "What key?" Laura asked. This was apparently news to her, and she seemed to resent that I knew more than she did.
Ray ignored her. "You still got it?" "With a little notice, I can lay hands on it," I said.
"Good. I don't want you going off without passing it over."
"You think I'm going to help you cheat Chester out of his fair share?"
"Hey, he'd do the same to me. He'll probably cheat you, too."
"I don't even want to get into that," I said.
"You think Johnny really did what he said?"
"I can't believe he'd put dough like that in limbo.
He'd have a backup plan, some kind of fail-safe, in case he got hit by a car, something like that. What makes you ask? You got any ideas yourself? I shook my head. It's just an interesting proposition. What's your strategy? My strategy is solve that problem when I come to it, he said. Once we hit the road again, Ray crawled in the back to sleep while I drove, and Laura took his place in the passenger seat. The two of us watched the silver ribbon of highway curl away beneath us. The lights on the dashboard threw off a soft illumination. In deference to Ray, we kept the radio turned down and confined our conversation to an occasional remark. Ray began to snore, a sputtering exhalation punctuated by quiet, as if someone were holding his nose shut at intervals. When it was clear that nothing short of a four-car flame-out was going to wake him, we began to chat in low tones. "I take it you never had a chance to spend time with him," I said. Laura shrugged. "Not really. My mother used to make me write once a month. She was always big on taking care of those less fortunate than we were. I can remember looking around, wondering who the hell she could be talking about. Then she remarried and seemed to forget about Ray. Made me feel guilty at first, till I forgot myself. Little kids aren't exactly famous for satisfying other people's needs." I said, "Actually, I think kids try to satisfy everyone. What other choice do they have? When you're dependent on someone, you better hope you keep them happy." Said like a true neurotic. "Are your parents still alive?" "No, they died together in an accident when I was 5. "Yeah, well, imagine if one of them suddenly showed up one day. You live your life wishing you had a father. Then suddenly you have one, and you realize you don't have the vaguest idea what to do with him." She cast an uneasy look in the back seat at Ray. If he was faking sleep, he was really good at it. I said, "Are you close to your mother?" "I was until Gilbert. She doesn't like him much, but that's probably because he never paid her much attention. She's a bit of a southern belle. She likes guys who fawn." "What about your stepfather? What's the story on him?" "He and Gilbert are as thick as thieves. He never wanted to believe Gilbert's hitting me was unprovoked. It's not like he approved. He just always assumes there's another side to it. He's the kind who says, 'Well, that's your story. I'm sure Gilbert would have something else to say about this.' He prides himself on being fair, not jumping to conclusions. Like a judge, you know, he wants to hear prosecution and defense arguments before he hands down his sentence. He says he doesn't want to be judgmental. What he really means is he doesn't believe a word I say. Whatever Gilbert does, I deserve, you know? He probably wishes he could take a pop at me himself." "What about your mother? Didn't she object to Gilbert's hitting you, or didn't she know?" "She says whatever Paul says. It's like an unspoken agreement. She doesn't want to rock the boat. She doesn't like conflicts or disagreements. All she wants is peace and quiet. She's just so thrilled to have someone taking care of her, she doesn't want to make waves. Paul always makes out like he's doing her such a big favor being married to her. I think she was 24 when they met. I was maybe 5 years old. So there she was, with an ex-husband in jail and no means of support. The only job she ever had was working as a drugstore clerk. She couldn't make enough to survive. She had to go on welfare, which she thought was the lowest of the low, her big shame. What the hell? She needed help. It's not like I was illegitimate, but in her eyes it was the worst. She never wants to have to sink to that again. Besides, with Paul, she doesn't have to work. He doesn't want her to. He wants her to keep house and cater to his every whim. Not a bad deal." "Yes, it is. It sounds grim." Laura smiled. "I guess it does, doesn't it? Anyway, when I was growing up, Paul was critical, authoritarian. He ruled the roost. He nearly broke his arm patting himself on the back for all he did for us. In his own way, he was good to her. He never gave a shit about me, but to be fair about it, I'm sure I was a pain. Probably still am, if it comes to that." She leaned her head back against the seat. "Are you married?" "I was." I held up two fingers. "You were married twice?" "Me too. Once to a guy with a substance abuse problem," she said, using her fingers to mark the phrase with quotes. "Cocaine?" That and heroin. Speed, grass, stuff like that. The other husband was a mama's boy. Jesus, he was weak. He got on my nerves because he was so insecure. He didn't know how to do anything. Plus, he needed all this reassurance. Like, what do I know? I'm hardly in a position to make somebody else feel good.
What about Gilbert?
He was great at first. His problem is he doesn't trust, you know. He doesn't know how to open up. He can really be so sweet. Sometimes when he drinks, he busts out crying like a baby. Breaks my heart.
Along with your nose, I said.
Chapter 15. We passed through Greenville, Brashear, Saltillo, and Mount Vernon, crossing sparsely wooded farmland on gently rolling hills. Laura fell asleep with her head against the window. Traffic was light and the road was hypnotic. Twice I jerked myself awake, having dropped into a moment of microsleep. To keep alert, I reviewed my intellectual Atlas of Texarkana Facts, discovering in the process that the entire category contained only two bits of information. First, the Arkansas-Texas state line bisects the town of Texarkana, so that half the population lives in Texas and half in Arkansas. And last, the town is the site of a federal correctional institution, about which I knew nothing else. So much for that form of mental stimulation. On the outskirts of town, I pulled into an all-night filling station, where I stopped to stretch my legs. Ray was still dead to the world, so Laura traded places with me and took the wheel. Laura pitched in $5, and we bought exactly that much gas. It was close to 10:30 when we crossed the state line, with approximately 2 hours to go until we reached Little Rock. I settled into the passenger seat, slouched on my spine, knees bent, my feet propped up on the dashboard. I crossed my hands for warmth. The remaining damp in my blazer enveloped me in a humid cloud of woolly smells. The drone of the engine, combined with Ray's staccato snores, had a tranquilizing effect. The next thing I knew, I was drooling on myself. I put my feet down and sat up straight, feeling groggy and disoriented. We passed a highway sign that indicated we'd left U.S. 30 and were now heading north on U.S. 40. How far to Little Rock?
We already passed Little Rock. This is Bisco coming up.
We passed Little Rock? I told you I wanted to stop,
I whispered hoarsely.
What was I supposed to do? You had the map and you were sound asleep. I had no idea where the airport was, and I didn't want to drive all over hell and gone trying to find it.
Why not wake me?
I tried once. I said your name and got no response.
Weren't there any road signs?
Not that I saw. Besides, they're not going to have any flights out at this hour. This is the boonies.
Get a clue, she whispered back. She reverted to a normal tone, though she kept her voice down in deference to Ray. It's time to find a motel so we can get a couple hours' sleep. I'm half dead. I about ran off the road more than once in the last hour.
I did a 360 scan of the terrain, spotting little in the dark beyond farms and occasional dense woods.
Take your pick, I said.
There'll be a town coming up, she said without concern.
Sure enough, we came to a townlet with a one-story off-road motel, its vacancy sign winking. She pulled into a small gravel parking lot and got out. She turned her back to the car and reached up under her jumper, apparently removing a wad of cash from the belly harness she wore. I gave Ray a nudge, and he rose from the depths like a diver in the process of decompressing. I said,
Laura wants to stop. We're both beat.
Fine with me, he said. He pulled himself into a sitting position, blinking with puzzlement.
We still in Texas?
This is Arkansas. We got Little Rock behind us and Memphis coming up.
I thought you were leaving us.
So did I. He yawned, giving his face a dry rub with his hands. He squinted at his watch, trying to see the dial in the scanty light.
What time is it?
After one. I could see Laura at the entrance to the motel lobby. The lights inside were dim, and the front door must have been locked because I saw her knock repeatedly, then cup her hands against the glass to peek in. Finally, some unhappy-looking soul emerged from the manager's office. Much animated conversation, hand gestures, and peering in our direction. Laura was admitted to the office, where I saw her at the counter, filling out the registration card. My guess was her being pregnant lent her an air of vulnerability, especially at this hour. A fistful of cash probably didn't hurt her cause. Moments later, she emerged from the office and returned to the car dangling two room keys, which she handed to me as she got back behind the wheel. "Ray gets his own room. I can't sleep with that racket." She started the car and pulled around to the rear. Ours were the last two rooms at the far end. There was only one other car, and it had Iowa plates, so I figured we were temporarily safe from Gilbert. Ray hauled one of his bags from the trunk, while Laura grabbed the duffel, and I took the armload of damp clothes I'd dumped. Maybe hanging them up overnight would finish the drying process and render them wearable. Ray paused at his door.
"What time in the morning?"
"I think we should be on the road by 6. If we're going, get on with it. No point fooling around," Laura said. "Open your drapes when you're up, and we'll do likewise." She glanced at me. "Okay with you?"
"Sure, it's fine."
Ray disappeared into his room, and I followed her into ours. Two double beds and a drab interior, complete with mustiness. If the color beige had an odor, it would smell like this. It looked like the kind of place where you wouldn't want to jump out of bed without making a noise first. Otherwise, you might inadvertently step on one of the scuttling hard-shelled bugs. The little fellow I saw had gotten trapped in the corner, where he was patiently pawing the walls like a dog wanting out. You can't squish those things without risking that sudden spurt of lemon pudding on the sole of your shoe. I hung my garments in the closet after a gingerly inspection. No brown recluse spiders or furry rodents in evidence. The bathroom boasted brown vinyl tile, a fiberglass shower enclosure, two plastic glasses wrapped in cellophane, and two paper-wrapped soaps the size of business cards. I pulled out my traveling toothbrush and weensy tube of toothpaste and brushed my teeth in wordless ecstasy. In the absence of a nightie, I slept in my borrowed underwear, folding the cotton coverlet in half for warmth. Laura went into the bathroom, piously shutting the door before she removed her belly harness. I was asleep within minutes and never heard her climb into her own creaking bed. It was still dark when she bumped me at 5:45 a.m.
"You want a shower first?" she asked.
"You go ahead."
The light blasted on in the bathroom, slanting across my face briefly before she closed the door. She'd opened the drapes, admitting illumination from the lights outside in the parking lot. Through the wall, I thought I could hear the shower next door, which meant Ray was awake. In prison, he'd probably always risen at this hour. Now a shower would be a luxury, since he'd have it to himself and wouldn't have to worry about sexual assault every time he dropped the soap. I raised up on one elbow and looked out at the auto body shop across the street. A 40-watt bulb burned above the service bay. Monday morning, and where was I? I checked the printed match packet in the ashtray. Oh, yeah. Whiteley, Arkansas. I remembered the road sign outside of town claiming a population of 523. Probably an exaggeration. I felt a sudden surge of melancholy, longing for home. In the crazy days of my youth, before herpes and AIDS, I used to wake up occasionally in rooms like this one. There's a certain horror when you can't quite remember who's whistling so merrily behind the bathroom door. Often, when I found out, I couldn't help but question my taste in male companionship. It didn't take long to see morality as the quickest way to avoid self-loathing. When Laura cleared the bathroom, fully dressed, the belly harness in place, I brushed my teeth, showered, and washed my hair with a diminishing sliver of soap. My blue jeans, while dry, were still suggestive of ashtrays and cold campfires, so I donned Laura's denim dress again. Just being clean gave me an enormous lift. I retrieved my hanging garments from the closet and took them out to the car. The drive had been taking us on a steady line to the north. Here the cold was more pronounced. The air felt thinner and the wind more cutting. Ray had pulled on a fleece-lined denim jacket, and as we got in the car, he tossed a sweatshirt to each of us. Gratefully, I pulled the sweatshirt over my head and wore my blazer over that. With the bulk of the sweatshirt, the fit was so tight I could hardly move my arms. But at least I was warm. Laura draped her sweatshirt across her shoulders like a shawl. I got in the back seat, waiting in the car while Laura dropped off the keys, and Ray poured loose change into the vending machine around the corner from the office. They came back to the car with an assortment of snacks and soft drinks that Ray distributed among us. After Laura had pulled onto the highway, we ate a breakfast that consisted of off-brand cola, peanuts, chocolate bars, peanut butter crackers, and cheese snacks, completely devoid of nutritional value. Laura put the heater on, and the car was soon filled with the soapy scent of Ray's aftershave. Aside from the battered face and splinted fingers, both of which looked vile, he was meticulous about his grooming. He seemed to have an endless supply of plain white T-shirts and chinos. For a man in his mid-60s, he seemed to be in good physical shape. Meanwhile, both Laura and I were looking more bedraggled by the hour. In the close quarters of the rental car, I could see that her dark auburn hair had been dyed to that flaming shade. Her part was slowly growing out, a widening margin of gray. The strands bordering her face showed a rim of white like the narrow matting on a picture frame. I wondered if premature graying was a family trait. The sun rose from behind a mountain of early morning clouds massed on the horizon, the sky changing swiftly from apricot to butter yellow to a mild clear blue. The land around us was flat. Looking at the map, I could see this portion of the state was part of the Mississippi floodplain, all the rivers draining east and south toward the Mississippi River. Lakes and hot springs dotted the map like rain splats. The northwest corner of the state weighted down with the Boston and Wachita Mountains. Laura kept her foot pressed firmly to the accelerator, maintaining a steady 60 miles an hour. We were in Memphis at 7. I kept an eye out for a payphone, intending to call Henry, but realized California was 2 hours behind. He tended to rise early, but 5 a.m. was really pushing it. Laura, sensing my train of thought, caught my eye in the rearview mirror. "I know you want to get home, but can't you wait until Louisville?" "What's wrong with Nashville? We'll be there by mid-morning, which is perfect for me." "You'll slow us down. Check the map if you don't believe me. We'll be coming in on 40, taking 65 north across the state line. The Nashville airport is over on the far side of town. We'll lose an hour." She passed the map back to me, folded over to the section she was talking about. I checked the relative distances. "You won't lose an hour. You're talking 20 minutes max. I thought you didn't want to go to Louisville, so what's the big hurry now?"
"I never said I didn't want to go. That's where I live. I said that's where Gilbert's going. I want to get my stuff out of the apartment before he shows up."
Ray said, "Forget your stuff. Buy new. Stay away from there. You make a trip to the apartment, you run right into him."
"Not if I can get there before he does," she said. "That's why I don't want to waste time taking her to the airport. She can do that in Louisville. It isn't that much farther."
I could feel my body heat up with rising irritation. "It's another 3 hours."
"I'm not stopping," she said.
"Who put you in charge?"
"Who put you?"
"Ladies, hey, knock it off. You're getting on my nerves. We got Gilbert to contend with. That's enough."
Ray turned to look at me, his manner solicitous.
"I have a suggestion. I know you're anxious to get home, but a few hours' delay isn't going to make any difference. Come to Louisville with us. We'll take you to my ma's where it's safe. You can take a hot shower and clean up while she runs your clothes through her machine."
He glanced at Laura.
"You come, too. She'd love to see you, I'm sure. How many years since you've visited your grandma?"
5 or 6, she said.
"See? She probably misses you like crazy. I'm sure she does," he said. "She'll fix a great home-cooked meal, and then we'll take you to the airport. We'll even pay for your ticket."
Laura took her eyes off the road. "We will? Since when?"
"Come on, she's only in this because of us. Chester's probably never going to pay her, so now she's out the bucks. What's it going to cost us? It's the least we can do."
"You're very generous with money you don't have," she remarked. Ray's smile faltered. Even from my position in the back seat, I could see the shift in his mood.
"You saying I'm not entitled to what's in there?"
he said, indicating her belly. "Of course you're entitled. I didn't mean it that way, but this is costing us plenty as it is," she said.
"So?"
"So you could at least ask me first. I got a stake in it, too. In fact, the last I heard, you were giving me the whole $8,000.
"You turned me down."
"I did not."
"You did when I was there," I said, practically sticking my tongue out at her.
"Would you tell her to stay out of our business? This has nothing to do with you, Kinsey, so mind your own beeswax."
I felt a laugh bubble up. "Be a sport. This is fun. I'm the adopted daughter. This is family dynamic. Isn't that what it's called? I read about this stuff, but I never got to experience it. Sibling rivalry's a hoot."
"What do you know about family?"
"Not a thing. That's my point. I like all this bickering, now that I've got the hang of it."
Ray said,
"Is that true? You don't have family?" "I have relatives, but no one close. Some cousins up in Lompoc, but none of this day-to-day stuff where people crank on each other and make trouble and act ugly."
"I lived a lot of years without family. It's my one regret," he said. "Anyway, will you come with us as far as Louisville? We'll get you home, I swear."
I'm a sucker when someone asks me nicely, especially an honorary father who smelled as good as he did. I said,
"Sure, why not? Your mother sounds like a trip."
"That she is," he said.
"How long since you've seen her?"
17 years. I was out on parole, but I got picked up on a violation before I got this far. She never came to see me in prison. I guess she didn't want to deal with it.
Having negotiated our agreement, we drove on in peace. We reached Nashville at 10:35, all of us hungry. Laura spotted a McDonald's, the golden arches visible off the Briley Parkway. She took the nearest off-ramp. As soon as we pulled into the parking lot, I saw her reach a hand under her jumper, where she made a discreet withdrawal from the Belly Button National Bank and Trust. Since mine was the only face unmarked by recent pounding, I was elected to go into the restaurant and purchase our lunch. To ensure variety in our diet, I bought an assortment of hamburgers, Big Macs, and quarter pounders with cheese. I also bought 2 sizes of French fries, onion rings, and Cokes large enough to make us pee every 20 minutes. I also picked up 3 boxes of animal crackers with nifty string handles for those of us good enough to clean our plates. To show how refined we ate while the car was still parked at the rear of the lot, and then took advantage of the restrooms before we hit the road again. This time Ray drove, Laura moved over to the passenger seat, and I stretched out in the back and took a nap. When I woke, I could hear Ray and Laura talking in low tones. Somehow the murmuring took me back to the car trips of childhood, my parents in the front seat exchanging desultory remarks. That's probably how I learned to eavesdrop originally. I kept my eyes closed and tuned into their conversation. Ray was saying,
"I know I haven't been any kind of father to you, but I'd like to try."
"I have a father. Paul's already been a father."
"Forget him. The guy's a turd. I heard you say so."
"When?"
"Last night in the car when you were talking to Kinsey. Said he criticized the shit out of you growing up."
"Exactly. I had a father, so why do I need 2?
"Call it a relationship. I want to be part of your life."
"What for?"
"What for? What kind of question is that? You're the only kid I got. We're blood kin."
"Blood kin? What bull?"
"How many people can you say that about?"
"Thankfully, not many," she said with acid.
"Skip it. Have it your way. I'm not going to force myself on you. You can do what you like."
"No need to take offense. This is not about you," she said. "That's just how life is. Let's be honest. I've never gotten anything from men except grief."
"I appreciate the vote of confidence."
The conversation trailed off. I waited a suitable few minutes, then yawned audibly as if just rousing myself. I sat up in the back seat, squinting out at the countryside as it whizzed past the car windows. The sun had come out, but the light seemed pale. I could see rolling hills carpeted in dull November green. The grass was still alive, but all the deciduous trees had dropped their leaves. The barren branches created a gray haze as far as the eye could see. In some areas we passed, I could see hemlocks and pines. In summer, I imagined the land would be intensely green, the hillsides dense with vegetation.
Ray was watching me in the rearview mirror.
You ever been to Kentucky?
Not that I remember, I said. Isn't this supposed to be horse country? I expected bluegrass and white fences.
That's closer to Lexington, northeast of here. The fences these days are black. Over in the far eastern part of the state, you have the coal fields of Harlan County. This is western Kentucky, where most of the tobacco's grown.
She doesn't want a travelogue, Ray. Yes, I do, I said. She was always taking cuts at him, which made me feel protective. If she was going to be the bad daughter, I was going to be the good. Show me on the map. He pointed to an area north of the Tennessee border between the Barren River Lake and the Nolan River Lake.
We just passed through Bowling Green, and we got Mammoth Cave National Park coming up on our left. We had time, we'd do the tour. Talk about dark. You go down in the caverns, when the guide turns out the lights, you can't see for shit. It's blacker than black, and it's dead quiet. 54 degrees. It's like a meatpacking plant. 300 miles of passageways they've found so far. Last time I went was maybe 1932, a field trip in school. Left a big impression on me. When I was in prison, I used to think about that. You know, one day I'd come back and take the tour again.
Laura was looking at him strangely. That's what you thought about? Not women or whiskey or fast cars?
All I wanted was to get away from overhead lights and the noise. The racket's enough to drive you nuts, and the smell. That's another thing about Mammoth Cave. It smells like moss and wet rocks. Doesn't smell like sweat and testosterone. It smells like life before birth. What's the word? Primordial.
Geez, I'm sorry I have to go back to California so soon. You're talking me into it, I said dryly.
Ray smiled. You joke, but you'd like it, I guarantee.
Primordial? Laura said with disbelief.
What, you're surprised I know words like that? I got my GED. I even took college classes. Economics and psychology and shit like that. Just because I was in prison doesn't mean I'm a fool. A lot of smart guys in prison. You'd be surprised, he said.
Really? She said, sounding unconvinced.
Yeah, really. I bet I can work a sewing machine better than you, for starters.
That wouldn't take much, she said.
This is very uplifting, sitting here talking to you. You really know how to make a guy feel good about himself.
Fuck you.
You're the one complains your stepdad is always putting you down. Why don't you do better, improve the situation, instead of acting like him?
Laura said nothing. Ray studied her profile and finally looked back at the road. The silence stretched uncomfortably, and I could feel myself squirm.
How far from here? About an hour and a half. How are you doing back there?
I'm doing good, I said. We reached Louisville just before noon, approaching the town on Highway 65. I could see the airport on our left, and I nearly whimpered with longing. We took an intersecting highway west through an area called Shively, bypassing most of the downtown business district. To our right, I could see the clusters of tall buildings, sturdy blocks of concrete, most of them squared off on top. Ahead of us was the Ohio River, with Indiana visible on the other side. We exited in an area called Portland, which was where Ray Rawson grew up. I could see his smile quicken as he took in the neighborhood. He turned toward me halfway, putting his arms across the seat back.
The Portland Canal's down that way. Locks were built 100 years ago to take river traffic past the falls. My great-grandfather worked on the construction. I'll take you over there if we have time.
I was more interested in catching a plane than seeing any of the local landmarks, but I knew the offer was part of his excitement at coming home. Having been incarcerated for most of the last 45 years, he was probably feeling like Rip Van Winkle, marveling at all the changes in the world at large. It might be a comfort that his immediate neighborhood seemed untouched by the passage of time. The streets were wide, trees showing the last vestiges of autumn leaves. Most trees were bare, but down the block I could see smatterings of yellow and red leaves remaining. On the street we'd taken, coming off the freeway, many house fronts had been converted into businesses. Signs for child care, a hair salon, a tackle shop selling live bait. The yards were uniformly small and flat, separated by chicken wire fences with dilapidated gates.
Dead leaves, like scraps of brown paper, choked the house gutters and littered the walks. 10- and 12-year-old cars were parked at the curbs. Older models were lined up in driveways with for sale signs painted on the windshields. Telephone poles were more plentiful than trees, and the wires cut back and forth across the streets like supports for tenting that hadn't been erected yet. Down a side street, I could see railroad cars sitting on a sidetrack. I would have bet money the neighborhood had looked this way since the 1940s. There was no evidence of construction, no indication of any old structures torn down or condemned to make way for the new. Shrubs were overgrown. The tree trunks were massive, obstructing windows and porches where once the overhanging branches had provided only dappled shade. Sidewalks had buckled, broken by the roots. 40 years of weather had picked at the asphalt siding on some of the houses. Here and there I could see fresh paint, but my guess was that nothing much had changed in the years since Ray had been here. As we pulled up in front of his mother's house, I could feel a heaviness descend. It was like the low, droning note in the score for a horror movie, the minor chord that betokens a dark shape in the water, or something unseen, waiting in the shadows behind the basement door. The sensation was probably simple depression, born of borrowed clothes, junk food, and erratic sleep. Whatever the genesis, I knew it was going to be hours before I could get on a plane for California. Laura turned off the ignition on the rental car and got out. Ray emerged on his side, searching the front of the house with wonderment. I had no choice but to join them. I felt like a prisoner, suffering a temporal claustrophobia so pronounced it made my skin itch. Chapter 16. Ray's mother's house was situated on a narrow lot, on a street occupied entirely by single-family dwellings. The house was a two-story red brick structure, with a one-story red brick extension jutting out in front. The two narrow front windows sat side by side, caged by burglar bars and capped with matching lintels. 3 concrete steps led up to the door, which was set flush against the house and shaded by a small wooden roof cap. I could see a second entrance tucked around on the right side of the house down a short walk. The house next door was a fraternal twin, the only difference being the absence of the porch roof, which left its front door exposed to the elements. Ray headed for the side entrance with Laura and me tagging along behind like baby ducklings. Between the two houses, the air seemed very chill. I crossed my arms to keep warm, shifting restlessly from foot to foot, eager to be indoors. Ray tapped on the door, which had ornamental burglar bars across the glass. Through the window I could see bright light pouring from a room on the left, but there was no sign of movement. Idly he talked over his shoulder to me. "These are called shotgun cottages, 1 room wide and 4 rooms deep, so you could stand at the front door and fire a bullet all the way through." He pointed up toward the second story. "Hers is called a humpback because it's got a second bedroom above the kitchen. My great-grandfather built both these places back in 1880.
"Looks like it," Laura said. He pointed a finger at her.
"Hey, you watch it. I don't want you hurting Grandma's feelings."
"Oh, right. Like I'd really stand here and insult her house. Geez, Ray, give me credit for some intelligence."
"What is it with you? You're such a fucking victim," he said.
Inside the house, another light came on. Laura bit back whatever tart response she'd formed to her father's chiding. The curtain was pushed aside, and an elderly woman peered out. In the absence of dentures, her mouth had rolled inward in a state of collapse. She was short and heavy-set, with a soft, round face, her white hair pulled up tightly in a hard knot wound around with rubber bands. She squinted through wire-frame glasses, both lenses heavily magnified.
"What you want?"
she bellowed through the glass at us. Ray raised his voice.
"Ma, it's me, Ray."
It took her a few seconds to process the information. Her confusion cleared, and she put her gnarled hands up to her mouth. She began to work the locks, deadbolt, thumb lock, and burglar chain, ending in an old-fashioned skeleton key that took some maneuvering before it yielded. The door flew open, and she flung herself into his arms.
"Oh, Ray," she said tremulously. "Oh, my Ray."
Ray laughed, hugging her close while she made wordless mewing sounds of joy and relief. Though plump, she was probably half his size. She had on a white pinafore-style apron over a house dress that looked hand-sewn, pink cotton with an imprint of white buttons in diagonal rows, the sleeves trimmed in pink rickrack. She pulled away from him, her glasses sitting crookedly on the bridge of her nose. Her gaze shifted to Laura, who stood behind him on the walk. It was clear she had trouble distinguishing faces in the cloudy world of impaired vision.
"Who's this?" she said.
"It's me, Grandma, Laura, and this is Kinsey. She hitched a ride with us from Dallas. How are you?"
"Oh, my stars, Laura! Dear love, I can't believe it. This is wonderful. I'm so happy to see you. Looky here, what a mess I'm in. Didn't nobody tell me you were coming, and now you've caught me in this old thing."
Laura gave her a hug and kiss, holding herself sideways to conceal the solid bulge of her belly harness. Ray's mother didn't seem to notice one way or the other.
"Let me take a look at you."
She put a hand on either side of Laura's face, searching earnestly.
"I wish I could see you better, child, but I believe you favor your grandfather Rawson. God love your heart. How long has it been?"
Tears trickled down her cheeks, and she finally put her apron up over her face to hide her embarrassment. She fanned herself then, shaking off her emotions.
"What's the matter with me? Get on in here, all of you. Son, I'll never forgive you for not calling first. I'm a mess. House is a mess."
We trooped into the hallway, Laura first, then Ray with me bringing up the rear. We paused while the old woman locked the doors again. I realized no one had ever mentioned her first name. To the right was the narrow stairway leading up to the second-floor bedroom, blanketed in darkness even at this time of day. To the left was the kitchen, which seemed to be the only room with lights on. Because the houses were so close to one another, little daylight crept into this section. There was only one kitchen window, on the far left-hand wall, above a porcelain and cast-iron sink. A big oak table with four mismatched wooden chairs took up the center of the room, a bare bulb hanging over it. The bulb itself must have been 250 watts, because the light it threw off was not only dazzling, but had elevated the room temperature a good 20 degrees. The ancient stove was green enamel, trimmed in black, with four gas burners and a lift-up stovetop. To the left of the door was an Eastlake cabinet with a retractable tin counter and a built-in flour bin and sifter. I could feel a wave of memory pushing at me. Somewhere I'd seen a room like this. Maybe Grand's house in Lompoc when I was 4. In my mind's eye, I could still picture the goods on the shelves. The cut-right waxed paper box, the cylindrical dark blue Morton salt box with the girl under her umbrella. When it rains, it pours. Sanka coffee in a short orange can, cream of wheat, the tin of Hershey's cocoa. Mrs. Rawson's larder was stocked with most of the same items, right down to the opaque mint-green glass jar with sugar printed across the front. The oversized matching screw-top salt and pepper shakers rested nearby. Ray's mother was already busy clearing piles of newspapers from the kitchen chairs, despite Ray's protests.
"Now, Ma, come on. You don't have to do that. Give me that." She smacked at his hand.
"You quit. I can do this myself. If you told me you were coming, I'd have had the place picked up. Laura's going to think I don't know how to keep house."
He took a stack of papers from her and stuck them in a haphazard pile against the wall. Laura murmured something and excused herself, moving into the back room. I was hoping there was a bathroom close by that I could visit in due course. I pulled out a chair and sat down, doing some visual snooping while Ray and his mother tidied up. From where I sat, I could see part of the dining room, with its built-in china cupboards. The room was crammed with junk, furniture and cardboard boxes making passage difficult. I caught sight of an old brown wood radio, a Zenith with a round dial set into a round-shouldered console the size of a chest of drawers. I could see the round shape of the underlying speaker, where the worn fabric was stretched over it. The wallpaper pattern was a marvel of swirling brown leaves. The room beyond the dining room was probably the parlor, with its two windows onto the street and a proper front door.
End of Disc 6. Disc 7.
The room beyond the dining room was probably the parlor, with its two windows onto the street and a proper front door. The kitchen smelled like a combination of mothballs and strong coffee sitting on the stove too long. I heard the shriek of plumbing, the flush mechanism suggestive of a waterfall thundering from a great height. When Laura emerged from the back room sometime later, she'd shed her belly harness. She was probably uncomfortable with the idea of having to explain her condition if her grandmother took notice. I tuned into the old woman, who was still grumbling good-naturedly about the unexpected visit.
"I don't know how you expect me to cook up any kind of supper without the fixings on hand."
"Well, I'm telling you how," Ray said patiently. "You put together a list of what you need, and we'll whip over to the market and be back in two shakes."
"I have a list working if I can find it," she said, poking through loose papers in the center of the table. "Frieda Green, my neighbor two doors down, she's been carrying me to the market once a week when she goes. Here now, what's that say?"
Ray took the list and read aloud in a fakey tone.
"Says pork chops with milk gravy, yams, fried apples and onions, corn bread."
She reached for the paper, but he held it out of reach.
"I never. It does not. Let me see that. Is that what you want, son?"
"Yes, ma'am."
He handed her the paper.
"Well, I can do that. I have yams out yonder, and I believe I still have some of them pole beans and stewed tomatoes I put up last summer. I just baked a batch of peanut butter cookies. We can have them for dessert if you'll pick up a quart of vanilla ice cream. I want real. I don't want iced milk."
She was writing as she spoke, large, angular letters drifting across the page.
"Sounds good to me. What do you think, Kinsey?" he asked.
"Sounds great."
"Oh, forevermore. Kinsey, shame on me for my bad manners. I forgot all about you, honey. What can I get you? I might have a can of soda pop here somewhere. Take a look in the pantry, and don't mind the state it's in. I've been meaning to clean that out, but hadn't got to it."
"Actually, I'd love to borrow your phone and a pen and scratch paper, if you don't mind."
"You go and help yourself, as long as you don't call Paris, France. I'm on a fixed income, and that telephone costs too much as it is. Here's you a piece of paper." "Laura, why don't you show her where the telephone is? Right in there beside the bed. I'll get busy with this list."
Ray said,
"I also promised she could throw some clothes in the washing machine. You have detergent?"
"In the utility room," she said, pointing toward the door.
I took the proffered pen and paper and moved into the bedroom, which was as stuffy as a coat closet. The only light emanated from a small bathroom that opened on the left. Heavy drapes were pinned together over windows with the shades drawn. The double bed mattress sagged in an iron bedstead piled with hand-tied quilts. The room would have been perfect in a 1940s home furnishings diorama at the state fair. All the surfaces were coated with a fine layer of dust. In fact, nothing in the house had seemed terribly clean, probably the byproduct of the old woman's poor eyesight. The old black dial telephone sat beside a crook-neck lamp on the bed table, amid large print books, pill bottles, lotions, and ointments. I flipped the light on and dialed information, picking up the numbers for both United and American Airlines. I called United first, listening to the usual reassurances until my call could be answered in the order it was received. Out of deference to Ray's mom, I refrained from searching her bed table drawer while I waited for the agent to pick up on his end. I did scan the room looking for the belly harness. Had to be around here somewhere. The agent finally came on the line and helped me get the reservations I needed. There was a flight from Louisville to Chicago at 7:12 p.m., arriving at 7:22, which reflected the hour's time difference. After a brief layover, I then connected to a flight departing from Chicago at 8:14 p.m., arriving in Los Angeles at 10:24, California time. The flight to Santa Teresa left at 11 o'clock and arrived 45 minutes later. That last connection was tight, but the agent swore the arrival and departure gates would be close to one another. Since I was traveling without luggage, he didn't think it would be a problem. He did advise me to get to the airport an hour in advance of flight time so I could pay for the ticket. He just put me on hold when Ray stuck his head in the door, a clean towel in one hand.
"That's for you," he said, tossing it on the bed. "When you finish your call, you can hop in the shower. There's a robe hanging on the door. Ma says she'll throw your clothes in the wash when you're ready."
I put a palm across the mouthpiece and said, "Thanks, I'll bring 'em right out. What about the stuff in the car?"
"She's got that already. I brought everything in."
He started to depart and stuck his head around the door again.
"Oh, I almost forgot. Ma says there's a 1-hour cleaners in the same mall as the market. You want to give me your jacket, I can drop it off before we go shopping and pick it up on the way back."
The agent had come back on the line and was already busy reconfirming the flight arrangements while I nodded enthusiastically to Ray. With the receiver still tucked in the crook of my neck, I emptied the pockets of my blazer and handed it to him. He waved and withdrew while I finished up the call. I headed for the bathroom, where, with a quick search, I uncovered the belly harness tucked down in the clothes hamper. I hauled it out and inspected it, impressed by the ingenuity of the construction. The housing resembled an oversized catcher's face mask, a convex frame made of semi-flexible plastic tubing wrapped with padding, into which countless bound packets of currency had been packed. Heavy canvas straps secured the harness once in place. I checked a couple of packets, riffling through 5, 10, 20, and $50 notes of varying sizes. Many bills seemed unfamiliar, and I had to assume were no longer in circulation. Several packets appeared to be literally in mint condition. It grieved me to think of Laura covering day-to-day expenses with banknotes that a serious collector would have paid dearly for. Ray was a fool to stand by while his daughter threw it all away. Who knew how much money still remained to be uncovered? I tucked the harness down in the hamper. I'm big on closure and not good at leaving so many questions unanswered. "However," she said, "this was not my concern. In 6 hours I'd be heading for California. If there were additional monies in a stash somewhere, that was strictly Ray's business." There was a blue chenille bathrobe hanging on a hook on the back door. I stripped out of the borrowed denim dress and underwear, pulled the robe on, and carried my dirty clothes out to the kitchen. Ray and Laura had apparently left on their errand. I could see yams on the stove, simmering in a dark blue and white speckled enamel pan. Quart mason jars of tomatoes and green beans had been pulled off the pantry shelves and placed on the counter. Briefly, I pondered the possibilities of botulism poisoning arising from improperly preserved foods. But what the heck? The mortality rate is only 65%. Ray's mother probably wouldn't have attained such a ripe old age if she hadn't perfected her canning skills. The door to the utility porch was open. The room wasn't insulated, and the air pouring out of it was frigid. Ray's mother went about her business as if unaware of the chill. An early model washer and dryer were arranged against the wall to the left. Tucked between them was a battered canister-style vacuum cleaner shaped like the nose cone of a spaceship. "I'm about to hop in the shower, Mrs. Rawson. Can I give you these?" I asked.
"There you are," she said. "I was just loading the few things Laura gave me. You can call me Helen if you like," she added. "My late husband used to call me Hell on Wheels."
I watched as she felt for the measuring cup, tucking her thumb over the rim so she could feel how far up the side the detergent had come. "I've been considered legally blind for years, and my eyes is getting worse. I can still make my way around as long as people don't go putting things in my path. I'm scheduled for surgery, but I had to wait until Ray come home to help out. Anyway, I'm just yammering on. I don't mean to keep you." "This is fine," I said. "Can I help with anything?"
"Oh, no, honey. Go ahead and get your shower. You can keep that robe on till your clothes is done. Won't take long with these old machines. My friend Frida Green has new, and it takes her 3 times as long to run a load through and uses twice at the water. Soon as I'm done with this, I'm going to put some cornbread together. I hope you like to eat."
"Absolutely. I'll be out shortly and give you a hand." The shower was a mixed blessing. The water pressure was paltry, the hot and cold fluctuating wildly in response to cycles of the washing machine. I did manage to scrub myself thoroughly, washing my hair in a cumulus cloud of soap suds, lathering and rinsing until I felt fresh again. I dried myself off and pulled on Helen's robe. I slipped into my Reeboks, my fastidious streak preventing me from walking around barefoot on floors only marginally clean. I'm generally not vain about my appearance, but I could hardly wait to get back into my own clothes.
Before returning to the kitchen, I used my telephone credit card to put in a long-distance call to Henry. He was apparently out somewhere, but his machine picked up. I said, "Henry, this is Kinsey. I'm in Louisville, Kentucky. It's after 1 o'clock here, and I've got a flight out at 7. I don't know what time we'll be heading for the airport, but I should be here for the next couple of hours. If it's possible, I need to have you meet me at the airport. I'm almost out of cash, and I don't have a way to get my car out of Hawk. I can try borrowing the money here, but these people don't seem all that dependable. If I don't hear from you before I leave, I'll call you as soon as I get to Los Angeles." I checked the telephone number written on the round cardboard disc in the middle of the dial, reciting Helen's number to him before I hung up. I ran a comb through my hair and moved back into the kitchen, where Helen put me to work setting the kitchen table. Ray and Laura came back with my blazer in a clear plastic cleaning bag and an armload each of groceries, which we unpacked and put away. I hung my blazer on the knob just inside the bedroom door. Laura followed me, moving on into the bathroom to take her shower. The wash must have been done because I could hear the dryer rumbling against the wall.